In the last episode, we discussed schools in the Midwest in particular, a surprisingly rich location for small liberal arts gems. In this episode, we'll be looking at a younger demographic and considering standardized testing for secondary schools. Tests such as the ISEE and SSAT. I'll be joined by Molly Levine. Molly is the co-founder and CEO of Lemon Tree Learning and brings a wealth of experience with a career spanning over 15 years, dedicated to supporting families and students in the domains of test preparation, general academic assistance, and executive functioning support. Before co-founding Lemon Tree Learning, Molly had a diverse educational background. She taught public speaking with a focus on empowering young students to find their authentic voice, collaborated closely with academic therapists to better understand how to support students with learning differences, and guided students through the intricacies of middle and high school admissions tests, as well as college admissions tests. She remains dedicated to taking a holistic approach to education to support her families, both academically and emotionally. Molly, welcome to the show today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I wanted to start by asking you about your background and specifically what got you into tutoring and coaching in the first place.
Yeah, great question. So I actually began my career coaching public speaking. So parallel, but not exactly what I do now. And I loved it. I loved teaching public speaking. I loved empowering students to find their authentic voices. In our classes, we studied famous speeches. We worked on body language, writing, speaking with a clear and confident voice. And, you know, I think at the heart of it, it was just really helping students find their authentic voice. There wasn't a right or wrong way of doing it, but who do they idolize, right? What figures did they find empowering? And so what does that inform about the person they want to be? And through this pretty holistic process, I was just taken with how much of a difference confidence can make in a student's academic career. And then long story short, because there's obviously time in between, but through that, I realized that I was interested in education beyond the communication side of things. So I transitioned more into the traditional academic field and worked closely with a number of educational therapists, studied executive functioning techniques, teaching models, started working closely with neurodivergent students as well as test prep students. And this was actually all in Los Angeles where I started. Wow. And when I moved to New York City, though, that's when I started Lemon Tree Learning.
When was that?
Gosh, we started Lemon Tree Learning. We've been up and running for about 5 years, maybe a little bit more. But I've lived in New York for longer than that. I essentially brought my private practice to New York. And that's what inspired Lemon Tree Learning. I was working with students here and started to get more demand than I could supply because I was all referral-based and sort of had to make a decision. And then when I met my partner, Joe, I think he saw that it's a bad feeling to have to turn down students or, you know, and so it was kind of like, okay, do we want to take on more tutors? Is that something that we feel like we can do in a powerful way? Because it's like, you know, it's our business baby. So it's that same process of letting go and saying, okay, I know I'm doing this. Can we then find the right team of tutors that can bring sort of the quality and the philosophies that I bring to my students?
Well, so that's interesting. I mean, we were just talking about this before because we both have young children that we're sending off to school. In a lot of ways, when you're sending a tutor off to help with clients that, you know, potentially are new, but potentially are ones that you're familiar with and you've worked with for maybe even years, there is a level of, I don't know if I want to call it anxiety or what that is. There's a trust exercise that happens there, a faith exercise.
Oh, big time. Yeah. And I mean, you know, it's so funny. It's like, it's such a parallel to my son and sending him to school for the first time. But I think it's like, you know, the first, like I remember our first pairing with a tutor outside of myself, you know, it's like looking at the clock. Okay, the session is starting now. You know, what are they doing? You know, emailing everyone right afterwards. And, you know, I think there was a certain amount of anxiety or fear or just that process of kind of letting go a little bit and trusting that I've done my job. You know, I've had a thorough interview process. I know and trust this tutor. And then that kind of beautiful realization that it's like, oh, you know, they can bring something that maybe I can't bring, and they can bring something better than I can bring. And, you know, not to say that one person is better than another, but it's like we started Lemon Tree Learning for a reason, because we wanted to support students outside of, you know, my areas of expertise and the subjects that I feel comfortable with, or the students that I feel I'm best suited for.
Not all tutors are going to line up with all people. I've had fantastic tutors that, you know, I've worked with for many years, you know, and 98% of the feedback they get is like, this person's fantastic. Like, but then they go to a new person, and the new person's like, well, I just, you know, they were too condescending, or they talk too much, or they
100%
or, you know, whatever the feedback is. And, you know, it's sometimes it is legitimate. I mean, if I were the parent and I saw that, I'd say, well, you know, maybe somebody else. But it's chemistry. It's chemistry between people. I mean, not everyone's going to want to marry everyone else.
Absolutely. It's 100% true. And I think it's almost what we do. I mean, there's almost an art in the pairing process. Like, I tell our families time and time again, when we're doing consultation calls, it's like, what are your students' hobbies? What teachers have they liked working with? Because I think the pairing process is an art. And, you know, we've had success sort of saying, well, such and such has a background in music, and we know this student is learning guitar, and so maybe there'll be some sort of like a common dialogue. And obviously we want our sessions to be effective and focused, but I think there's also an art to that. The student needs to trust the tutor. They need to enjoy speaking with them. So if there's, you know, 30 seconds of, oh, hey, what are you working on, you know, in guitar, that's going to set up us up to have a better session than, you know, sort of the rigidity of saying like, okay, you know, I am a faceless, nameless person. Let's, you know, start working on ISEE prep.
Oh yeah. I mean, having something in common, sure. If you can line those things up. I mean, yeah, that's definitely an art form. Yeah. And I think, you know, to your point before about the switch between just being a contract tutor and then actually working with other people and sending them out, yeah. I think the reach is much farther that way too.
Yes.
And if you have a sort of central or core philosophy, and I think that that naturally does happen as you sort of collecting your tutors and vetting them and developing a relationship with them, that your organization sort of takes on an identity and a personality that can then sort of be imbued in your student population, your reach on that philosophy is just far greater than obviously you can do on your own.
100%. And I don't know if you find this too, but when I'm looking for new tutors, I'm looking for tutors that I feel like if somebody does a consultation call with me and my philosophies, you know, my outlook resonates with them, the tutor that shows up is going to mirror that. And that doesn't mean to say that I'm trying to hire me's, because again, it's like, you know, I want to hire people that I feel like can support students beyond what I can do. But at the same time, I want there to be that core value in place. I don't want there to be any surprises when a tutor shows up and the family says, well, I thought we were going to get holistic support and this tutor is very strict. Or, you know, it's like there should be a common link between myself and all the tutors that we work with.
Absolutely.
And I think there also needs to be, I always look for good listeners. So when I'm going through the interview process and I find that, you know, I'm speaking with a tutor and I feel like there isn't a flow to the conversation because let's say, you know, the question is to bring their resume to life and tell me about their experience. And it feels like it's sort of a one-sided conversation. That's a red flag for me because I sort of think like, okay, you know, if they're sitting there with the student, you know, half of what we do is being able to listen and diagnose and get silent and really kind of take in where a student is at and where we can sort of, you know, find our way in to help.
You mentioned your husband. You're operating in a sort of partnership and running an organization with Joe, I think you said.
Yeah, that. Yeah. Joe is my husband and business partner. Yeah, I mean, I know that everyone says, you know, don't start a business with your partner, but we've actually found it to be quite a wonderful setup. I think we bring very different skills to the table. It was Joe who honestly pushed and inspired me to do this. I think he saw how excited I was when I was like working with students one-on-one and how much I loved it. And I think for him, you know, that sort of love felt a little contagious. And he also saw when I was like, oh, I just don't have room in my schedule for these students. You know, he has more of a background in data science and business. So I think for him, it was sort of natural to say, well, you know, what if we then built Lemon Tree Learning and did X, Y, and Z? And so he's always been more of the sort of infrastructure, introducing apps, streamlining the business, you know, the stuff that is not my forte. I'm better at curriculum and communication and, you know, talking and working with our students and families. And
you have more humanities background, don't you?
Yes, yes, exactly. And he has more of a math and science background. And so I think it works because we have very different skill sets. And I think he does a great job at what he does. And I think he feels the same way. So there's no need to really step on each other's toes or micromanage. So it works. I mean, I think, you know, like the challenge of it is honestly that it bleeds into your personal life. Like we'll go out on a date night and talk about our students or the business, or he's like, I was just testing this app and, you know, I want you to take a look at it. I think this could be a better scheduling tool than, you know, or we run group diagnostics during testing season. So we have like all of our test prep students come to a space and hold a group diagnostic to get them acclimated, you know, because we are husband and wife and we've got a kid and we run these on the weekends, you know, we show up together with our 4-year-old. That can be challenging, but I also think that's kind of nice. Like I think it's, you know, I get excited to show Lewis what we do and
the business. Right?
Yeah, exactly.
What types of, I mean, you just actually hinted at some of the things you did there. That's interesting. You run a group diagnostic. That's a great idea to simulate the test environment. But
yes.
What other type of services do you offer at Lemon Tree? And what would you describe as your sort of signature service? Like what is your, you know, prototypical situation look like?
Yeah, I mean, so we do a lot. We do test prep, the middle school admissions test, because it's New York City, going from elementary to middle to high school to college. I mean, there's always tests and applications involved. So we do prep for all of those tests, middle school, high school, college. We do essay support. We do general academic support, specialized support. If we have a student that needs help in living environment, say, we do executive functioning support. And most times, I'd say our sort of two most signature asks are academic support with some executive functioning skills thrown in. So essentially saying, you know, we want our child to have homework help to, you know, focus on the individualized subjects, but they also need help with study skills and organizing how and when and what they're going to work on. We work with a lot of students with learning differences, ADHD, anxiety disorders. And then, of course, we do a ton of the high school admissions tests. So the specialized high schools in New York City, the private high schools, and I'd say that and, you know, the homework support are pretty much our biggest asks.
Do you find it tricky sort of striking a balance between focusing on one particular set of services versus kind of covering the gamut? Because that is a wide variety of things. However, I would say that when you're dealing with tutors, often they are very versatile, especially at this level. So they can certainly handle that many things. But I mean, that's kind of something that I struggle with, which is where do I want to draw the line as to what I don't do? You know, what do we not offer and how focused and specialized do we want to be versus the ability to sort of cover all things?
I struggle with that too. I think generally I have a personality that I want to help. If a parent says my child needs support in this subject, I'm going to say, oh yeah, I want to help them. So I struggle with that too. And if we ever don't have a tutor that can support a family, you know, in a particular area, of course, I'll be transparent, but then I'll probably have that like seed planted and I'll talk to Joe and I'll say, should we get, you know, like a speech and language therapist? Is that something that we should, you know, we should look into? And I've found in general as a business model that anytime I sort of have ideas that are outside of what's being asked, that's not as productive as just kind of letting the ask guide me. So generally when I have those thoughts of, oh, should we get this? Usually the answer is no. It's like, let's focus on, you know, what is, to your point, sort of the main ask so that we can make sure we're doing that well. And we have tutors on hand that can do that well. You know, it's funny because it's like, I sort of think we are specialized in what we do, but it's funny hearing you ask that and me sort of talk about everything we do. I'm like, oh, we do a lot. But I always, you know, the areas that I don't touch on are admissions guidance. So anytime a family calls us and they say, can you help direct us in terms of like which high schools to apply to, I will always tell them there is someone better to do that, you know? So I think our specialty is test prep and academic support, you know, and then we have tutors that have all these different areas of expertise.
Totally.
We have tutors that can do French, Spanish. We have one tutor that can support students studying Chinese or Mandarin more specifically. Yeah. But then sometimes I'll get parents that sort of say, you know, we want, you know, math and Spanish support, or we want across the board coverage plus a language. You know, we do have tutors that can do that, but
you're not going to find a calculus teacher that you're going to want like to do writing instruction. That's not going to go well.
Right. Or I find that, you know, because we do in-person and virtual, you know, the tutor, like the, you know, the one to two tutors that can do that and across the board, and we've worked with them for years and trust that, you know, there's going to be quality and like we truly believe that they can do that. They might at this point like only have time for virtual students. And so there's oftentimes there can be a compromise depending on like how specific the ask is.
Right. I mean, I think I'm finding at this point as a general trend that a lot of parents, you know, that are operating at our level really are looking for in-person tutoring.
Yes.
For the most part. We do get virtual requests, but it's far more rare. I'd say probably at this point, maybe 25% of our population is online, maybe even less.
Yeah, I'd say it's the same breakdown for us, but I've noticed that there is a lot of understanding parents because this is our busy season. So right now our tutors are kind of maxed out. And so the consultation call requests I'm getting now, the conversation is, you know, we can do this, but, you know, the only sort of space available is online. And I found that parents are, because we're so versed with online and because we've had so much experience with it, I can also guarantee that it's going to be like the quality will be there, whether it's in person or online, you know, depending on how important the ask is, you know, like a student that's taking an admissions test in 8 weeks, they'll say it's fine, you know, online.
Right. Well, I would say this, there is a bit of a stigma maybe associated with online learning at this point, just because of like the pandemic had an impact on that. And a lot of people had a bad experience, I'd say, with online learning. They're like, well, we don't want that. That's the cheap, poor way of doing things. But there's a higher quality online of tutoring. You're just, you have 100 times more choice.
Yes.
In terms of the person that you're getting. So they're going to be 100 times better. I mean, there's a direct relationship correlation there.
Yeah.
You know, just statistically, you know, my best tutors are online.
Yeah.
That's just a reality of the situation. But I would say this personally, after, you know, doing this for a long time, hybrid is awesome. And this is my ideal circumstance. You have two or three sessions, maybe in person, and then you migrate to online. So you develop a relationship and you realize the person's actually like a flesh and blood, like human being. It's not just on a screen. You get that foundation. And then online, there's just such flexibility. The scheduling is 10 million times easier. You're in the kid's computer with them. So you're like right there editing the essay or doing whatever the assignment is. You know, it's just very convenient and versatile in that way. Efficient, I guess is the word I'd use for it.
Yeah, it's funny. I have some students like similar that we do both with. And I still see some students myself, but I try to do it on a very limited basis. And one of my students, or a pair of them, they're siblings, they're test prep students. And we do one day online and one day in person. And I will get there in person. And while I love it and there's its advantages, I'm trying to explain a concept. And my first thought is, wait, where's my whiteboard? And then it's like, okay, wait, no, we're in person. You know, here's our notebook, here's the scrap paper. But it's like the features that online offers are really great. I mean, the whiteboard feature, the interactive, I think honestly, they're both just as effective. And it really just comes down to like, what's the family's preference?
Here are a few observations I had after the first segment of my conversation with Molly. We focused a lot on tutoring organizations, of course, since we had sort of a lot in common there. And I think there were some really important themes that came out of that discussion. One really is that philosophy in terms of matching, that is really a bit of an art form trying to figure out what type of chemistry you're going to have between a tutor and a student. And you don't really want too many misses. I think rarely will you get to second and never really third. I think students get fairly discouraged if you're really not kind of finding that match almost right away. It's, I think, maybe difficult to go down that path of vulnerability for a student to begin with. So it's kind of important that you get it right to begin. So that can be a fairly important skill. And I think really what sets apart good tutoring organizations from average ones. Another theme in our conversation dealt with the focus of a particular organization. Do you want to really look into tutoring organizations that have a very niche focus, say, for instance, high school math only, versus one that's perhaps a bit broader, covers college, high school, lower schools, and has all of these different services to it? I would argue that that's perhaps asking the wrong question, because there are, I think, plenty of specialized organizations that aren't necessarily very good. And there are plenty of generic ones that do have a lot of good tutors. So the tendency is to think that if, you know, some sort of service, whether it's tutoring or a doctor or an auto mechanic or anything like that, the more specialized a person, the more high quality their service is going to be. I haven't found that necessarily to be true in practice. So I think it's kind of wise, if you're in the market for tutoring, to set that consideration really aside when you're evaluating the quality of tutoring organizations. Another thing that I observed was both of our journeys and a sort of departure from being almost exclusively an individual tutor, which I did start out as myself, and it sounded like she did as well, to more of a system of deploying subcontractor tutors for me. I think you have a far greater reach if you're bringing in those tutors and you're able to bring them under your umbrella and train them in terms of your philosophy, bring them into that world that you've created in an effective way that they can then sort of give that to another human being, to a one that's in a vulnerable adolescent stage. The reach is far greater. I don't necessarily get to enjoy the nuance of a particular relationship as much as I used to, because I don't do as much tutoring as I did when I first started. So I don't get to see that growth. And to some degree, I guess I missed that. But I think my reach has been far greater. And at the end of the day, I feel really good about being able to help a lot of kids in the system that I've established now versus being an individualized tutor. And I certainly heard that in Molly's description of her career track as well. So could you just kind of outline the standardized testing, you know, that's out there for secondary school? You know, what are the tests and their various profiles?
Yeah, absolutely. So we've got the private school admissions tests, which are the ISEE and the SSAT. And then in New York City, we also have the specialized high school tests, which are a big one for us. And that's the SHSAT, the SHSAT. The thing with these tests is that they are all above grade level. You know, I'd say the ISEE probably more so than the SHSAT, but you know this. I'm happy to sort of, you know, walk your listeners through the different sections, or I don't know if that's going to be a little bit repetitive based on content you've already covered. But I mean, these tests are above grade level.
What do you mean by that when you say it's above grade level?
So generally, when we start, we do a diagnostic test, and I'd say 95% of our students, the ones that are working at the top of their class, have, you know, 98% averages, will go into these tests and probably score below the 25th percentile without any support, you know, without just cold, without seeing the test, without starting tutoring, because they've probably learned, you know, 5% of the content in school. Even the English, the types of passages, the vocabulary, the types of questions, the time element, it's just the kids are not versed in these tests. And I've noticed that there are some schools that when we work with their students, those kids start with a little bit of a leg up because they do competitive testing with time elements and they're just a little bit more versed, or maybe they have a more advanced math curriculum. But for the most part, when the kids are following Common Core, they are not ready for these tests.
Yeah. So what are the similarities and the differences between the ISEE and the SSAT and the SHSAT? How do you sort of recommend that parents approach the nuances in deciding which tests they want to utilize?
So the ISEE versus the SSAT, I think they're pretty equal. You know, I have some parents that say, like, we've heard the SSAT math is easier than the ISEE. And I do think in some ways it's a little bit more comprehensive. You know, on the ISEE, there is the quantitative reasoning section, I think, gets more into sort of the theoretical applications of math. And that can be challenging when students haven't learned these sort of advanced applications of concepts that they've worked on in school. But really, I think they are equally as challenging. When push comes to shove, when we start prep for either one of these tests, I think it is an equal jump into, you know, into very similarly leveled content.
So would you say it's entirely arbitrary, or how, I mean, how do you kind of pick between the two?
Yeah, I mean, it's similar to the SAT versus the ACT. I think if we have the luxury of time, you know, if a family contacts me a year out, we'll look at the sections with the kids that are different, like the verbal section, for example. You know, the ISEE's got sentence completion, the SSAT has an analogy section, and we just kind of get a sense for, you know, what the students prefer. We'll sort of do snippets of the math. Mm. I think reading comp is pretty similar. And, you know, obviously there are, like, you know, nuanced differences between them. The amount of answer choices, you know, on the SSAT is greater, 5 versus 4. But really, it's just a preference thing. And I don't know why, but I'd say most of our students take the ISEE. Have you found that as well versus the SSAT?
I'd say we get sort of half and half.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. You know, it's about equal.
Do you approach it similarly? Like, how do you sort of guide families to choose one versus the other?
Well, I mean, generally, when we've gotten these cases, they already have a sense of what they want to do, because, you know, either the school district has scheduled the test already, so they're already set to take that, or, you know, so the element of choice has kind of been removed from it, or, you know, they just already have a sense independently because they've done the research and they want to go a certain direction. But I mean, if you are stuck between the two, flip a coin. Yeah. I mean, in an ideal world, you have the kid take two diagnostics.
Yeah. Right?
So you have them take an SSAT and you have them take an ISEE and see which one they do better on, right? Yeah. Or at least the one that they find more identifiable, that they I don't know what the word is for it, the one that makes the most sense, like testing standpoint. Like, because it's a matter of execution.
When you're
talking about these standardized tests, it's not just understanding. It's how well you execute in a given time frame. So if you have the time to do a diagnostic of both, great. But I mean, they're like 3-hour tasks.
I know. And it's one thing, you know, for college admission students, it's oftentimes an easier ask to say, let's take both tests, or most of them have already taken the PSAT by the time they come to us. So then it's like, let's just take the ACT before we decide. But I find that it's a harder ask to ask a 7th grader, you know, to sit down for 2 separate 3-hour occasions when they've got soccer or fencing or martial arts. And so usually we'll just go through the differences between them and try to help the families make an educated decision. But I do think it's kind of flip a coin. You know, there are differences between the tests, and it's just a matter of, like, which one is going to feature the student skills more.
It's really difficult to be that granular without actually taking the diagnostic and really doing an analysis of it. You know, you couldn't say on a generic level, oh, well, he's stronger in math than he is in, you know, the language, therefore you should take XYZ test. It's just not that generic.
Exactly. And there was one student that was taking the ISEE with us, and his verbal and reading scores were exceptional, but was really struggling with the math. And we suggested he look at the SSAT to see if he liked it more. He did. We went that route and then found then his verbal and reading scores suffered because for whatever reason, the SSAT didn't complement, you know, what he felt comfortable there. So, you know, then we sort of have to course correct and try to just make the best decision we can in terms of what's going to, you know, feature the student's skills better. And then the SHSAT, the specialized high school admissions tests, I guess you probably don't see that a lot.
You don't? No.
Yeah, because that's New York City based. That one, actually, I love prepping for that one. I think the city does a great job at releasing enough source material that there's no wild card there. I think it is more approachable than the ISEE in that it's a little bit more in line with what the kids are covering in school. And I really appreciate it when these tests release enough material that we can practice, you know, we can take 14 practice tests that have been written by the same person that's writing the actual test, or not the same person, but the same company. You know, I think that there's something empowering about that.
Do you have advice for how to prepare for the exams? What are the sort of the best practices that these students should take or that the parents should take in support of
them? Yeah. So I think, you know, we treat the math and the English a little differently. I think for the math, we've had the most success with essentially breaking down all the math that comes up into units and concepts. And literally, if we have the luxury of time, you know, and it's obviously a different approach if a family says, we want to hire you to prep our child for 4 weeks, you know, then that's a little bit of a different process. But assuming we have the time, taking a methodical approach to the math, so we feel like content-wise, they have the skills. And then from there, we start doing, you know, more of the time element, the strategy part of it, you know, themes to the questions, what to look out for, when can you use your answer choices and save time. And then from there, focusing on the stamina aspect. So, you know, whether that's like drilling an entire practice section for homework, doing group diagnostics with our company, doing group diagnostics on your own. But I have found that it's like focusing on the methodical actual meat and potatoes math that comes up and then transitioning to a little bit more strategy.
Totally. We tend to focus on what I would call execution strategies in the last couple of weeks. Because yes. I think a lot of that stuff maybe is not obvious to a 12-year-old to a 13-year-old. You know, when you're talking about, well, it's smart to get enough sleep, not just the night before, but the three nights before. It's smart to eat breakfast that's not like a Pop-Tart. Like these are things that perhaps are more obvious to adults, but you know, maybe not to 13-year-olds.
Yeah.
So covering that a week before the test is smart because they're going to forget if you tell them 2 months.
Absolutely. And I think that's similar to, you know, our holistic approach where it's like, you know, we're not machines. So it's like, you know, what psychologically is going to help. We found that sometimes with test-taking anxiety, helping to give the kids mantras, you know, to go into the test and sort of combat that fear, because we all know when we feel nervous, it's harder to zoom in and focus on a problem. I was talking to a parent after our most recent group diagnostic, and she told me that her child was like listening to the ticking of her watch, could tell her every conversation that happened in the room on breaks. And, you know, and it's like, okay, we're dealing with some test-taking anxiety here. The student is like not able to focus on what's in front of them because of this fear and focusing on all the external environments.
What is the best timing for taking these tests? Do you have any advice as far as, you know, lining that up?
I mean, I hate to say it because I am such a holistic person and believe in a balance in life and work, and kids should get to go on vacation and go to camp. But I do think that if you can start these tests a year out, honestly, that's awesome, because then it becomes a holistic process. You know, we're not scrambling. We're not trying to learn material sort of last minute. But, you know, I mean, I say that, but there's also no prescription to what's going to work. I mean, we've started prep with students in September leading up to, you know, a Shasat that Shasat ended up happening in mid-November. It was during the pandemic, so the date was changed.
I've had parents call me on Wednesday and tell me that the test is on Saturday. Like, what can you do for this kid?
It's like, well, we can get them acclimated. It's better than nothing. No, totally. And so, you know, I hate to say it, but I sort of think as much time as we have, the better. I mean, there are times that are too early, right? You know, we don't need to start Shasat prep in fifth grade, but we can also work with the kids just on general test-taking skills, trying to introduce them to more advanced level concepts sort of at a young age. And I think that can be helpful. But yeah, if we have a solid year for these tests, or even starting in January for November of the same year, that's also great timing. I just sort of panic right now. I'm in the getting calls from parents about tests happening in a month, 2 months, and that's always a little challenging.
And I think we've had success
with students starting 3 to 4 months ahead of the test, but depending on where they're starting at, I just feel like most of our students haven't learned any of this content. So even starting 3 to 4 months ahead of time, it does feel like we have to cram a little bit. And just because I make this into a easeful, positive, supportive process, we try to avoid cramming, you know? And so I don't know. I wonder if that's also a different sort of New York City thing versus Connecticut thing. But I find that we have a lot of parents that do want to start these a year in advance. And what I like about that is the tutor can feel like a little bit more of a mentor. And it's like, oh, hey, we're just showing up to learn some really challenging material. Let's make this fun, you know, so it's not like, you know, go, go, go. And then the child is burnt out by the time they take the tests. It can feel like a little bit more gradual.
So how important are these scores actually when you're talking about applying to schools? Because, I mean, that's why we're doing it, right? How much does it figure into those applications?
So for the Shasat, it's everything. The specialized schools have no other qualifying aspect than these tests. So it becomes really important if a family wants to do a specialized high school, which I understand. I mean, they're great schools. They're public, so the financial ramifications are excellent. And so for these specialized high schools, literally, they just accept. I mean, there's a whole algorithm to which school, you know, because there's eight of them and scores. But essentially, it's like the higher your score is, you are put sort of first on the priority list for your first choice, you know, and then it just kind of goes down the list from there. And they are very competitive and the tests are very rigorous. And so for the Shasat, it's everything. For the ISEE, it used to be a huge factor, but now that so many schools have gone test optional since COVID, it's a little bit of a different game. You know, I sometimes will talk to parents about like create your list of schools, because if you're applying to all test optional schools, then it might not be worth it to put in the time for, you know, ISEE or SSAT prep. But more times than not, there's always like one school that requires it, or that the parents just want to see, could my child do so well on this that it is a deciding factor in helping to like push their application over. But yeah, for the private schools, you know, there's enough that are test optional and enough that are not test optional that I find that kids still need to take these tests.
Here are some observations that I had after my conversation with Molly in the second segment. It was interesting when she was talking about the secondary school tests and how they were being sort of administered above grade level, the way she described it. So you have these kids that are getting all A's and they get these test results back and it says, oh, you're the 75th percentile. Well, that sounds terrible if you're in seventh grade, but that can actually be very good if you're in the 75th percentile above your own grade level. You're about 3/4 of the kids in the country. So being able to interpret those, I think those results, is a very undersold sort of part of this whole process. As the College Board and other testing organizations have become more elaborate in their testing, there has been an evolution, not only in terms of the testing, but also in terms of the results that you're getting. Being able to analyze those results and manage expectations, I think, which is a crucial part of the process, really is quite helpful, and it's getting harder and harder to do as we go on. Another theme was the difference between the two tests that we talked a lot about, ISEE and SSAT. I think at the end of the day, it's fairly arbitrary. You know, you can point to a lot of nuanced details between the two tests. And certainly, I think if you want to get to that granular detail of which skills, which particular skills, like analyzing graphs or tackling word problems that my child is good at compared to the median, if you want to get down to that scale, then perhaps you can make a decision that does give you a bit of an advantage. I think at the end of the day, you should probably let circumstance determine which test you're going to go for and then stick with that decision. Whether the circumstance is that the school is administering a particular test or one is more convenient or it lines up better in terms of the scheduling, I think that's wiser to kind of let that lead the process. Another thing that I wanted to bring up was this element of mindfulness and that sort of dimension, really, to put it more broadly, execution strategies, the way we describe it. You know, mindfulness, I think, is critical. As I always say, you can understand the quadratic formula perfectly, but if you put the minus sign in the wrong place because you didn't sleep well the night before, you're going to get that question wrong. So execution is really half of the battle. And as science has proven over and over and over again, yeah, sleep is very important. I would probably put that maybe near the top of the list. Mindfulness is pretty critical too. And if you're doing those meditations or those practices that increasingly are seen as sort of game changers in terms of your mental faculties and your ability to sort of manage this intellectual marathon, they're key. But you know, the kid has to buy in. I mean, if the student's not going to buy into that strategy, to applying that, then you're not going to get anywhere with it. So I think that is the place where really developing a rapport and a trust with that student is so key and makes all the difference. If you can meet them at a place where they are, if you can identify sincerely with their interests and give them some sort of positive feedback and get inside there with their identity a little bit, that is when you can start to plant the seeds of perhaps things that they're unfamiliar with or maybe traditionally haven't been that willing to try. Well, if they see somebody that they respect, some sort of mentor or figure like that, telling them, hey, this is a smart idea, I think that's when you can sort of plant the seeds of things like that that can really, really help them. But it's really a matter of finding that right person that's going to be able to plant those seeds to get that hook in that really ends up being critical in the long run. How would you say the post-pandemic era has impacted secondary school testing? You know, specifically, I guess I'm thinking of with the older tests or migrating to sort of online versions. Do you think they'll do that with the secondary school testing? What are you kind of seeing in terms of the way that they're running these tests?
Absolutely. I mean, the pandemic has changed things dramatically. So all of these tests now have online options. I think the scores are more competitive than they've ever been because of the test optional aspect. You know, generally, if a school is test optional, they'll say only submit this score if it's kind of in like a percentile that's equal to better than your school grades. And I go over this with our parents, but the percentiles on these tests are very different. You know, to be in the top 75th percentile and above is really excellent, even though if you get a 75 on a test, you know, you might not have that same reaction. So to even feel like you want to submit the scores, the kids really need to do exceptionally for these test optional schools. You know, the ones that still require it, I think, still have a slightly different way of viewing them. But I've also noticed that there's a lot of gaps in the kids' knowledge. So like maybe depending on when the pandemic happened, they missed, you know, fractions. So the tests themselves haven't changed beyond offering an online option. But I think the expectations for the tests have changed and where the students are at has changed.
If you had sort of one parting piece of advice for parents of younger students looking at that secondary school, what is that sort of one overarching piece of advice that you would give?
Yeah, that's a great question. I have a few. Can I give a few pieces of advice?
Yes, absolutely. Yes, be greedy. Please do.
So I've talked a lot about math. I have found that our students who are voracious readers will tend to be a little bit more ready for the reading and the verbal sections of these tests. And I think as much as parents can cultivate a love of reading, I mean, whether that's at home or with a tutor, to have a private book club or with a group of friends. And I think the books that the kids should be reading need to be challenging. You know, there is a difference in terms of the material that is presented on these tests and the material that they might pick up from, you know, a bookstore that they think, oh, this looks good. And I had one parent that asked me if reading the newspaper was a good idea. And absolutely, because I think anything that kind of introduces
anything. I mean, read the back of a cereal box.
Exactly. But I think it acclimates the kids to grammar rules without even necessarily cognizantly thinking about it. Vocabulary, analytical thinking. You know, I think depending on the kids' interests, older writers, you know, Mark Twain, I think that we don't really incorporate that into school content as much.
Well, syntax. I mean, the way the sentences are structured is very unusual. And that diversity, I think, is a really great way of learning.
Exactly.
You're analyzing those differences in your head subconsciously.
100%. Yeah. And I think, you know, if you have the time and the means or the relationship with your child, I think also going a little bit above and beyond Common Core, you know, from an early age and just sort of saying, this is interesting. Let's sort of start to explore in a very holistic, fun way, more advanced applications to this math. Because I think these are sort of the things that I've noticed can make the test prep process easier. But I also want to say that life is not about test prep. So, you know, I say all of this because I've noticed that these things help our students in the test prep process, but I don't want a parent to listen to this and think, oh my gosh, I need to cater my life around doing well on these tests. Yes. Because there's a million ways to enrich your child. And I think as parents, there are limits to the roles we can play in our child's life. And I think that's why you know, not to make this about hiring a tutoring company, but I think that that's also the allure of hiring a tutoring company is that we have parents all the time say like, can you suggest a book to my child because they won't listen to me.
Yeah. I mean, anyone who's not their parents.
I think it's important also to remember that there's not one path to success. I mean, there's not one school that a student will get into that then will lead to X, Y, and Z. I think, you know, we all have different ambitions and dreams, and there are going to be supportive and positive places, you know, everywhere that support that.
Perhaps characteristic of our generation of parents is just we have these big dreams and ambitions for, you know, sometimes for the things that we feel that we didn't get, like when we were kids, and, you know, all the gifts and things that we feel that we have to give to the next generation. It's hard not to get carried away.
Oh, absolutely. I find that too with my 5-year-old where, you know, because this is my world and I do it all the time, I find myself thinking like, oh, I want to make sure that I'm not sort of making my vocabulary smaller when I talk to them because I want them to be exposed to all of it. And then it's like, oh my gosh, my son is 5. And
Yeah, exactly. Here's some final observations after my conversation with Molly. We discussed a lot about really the role of the test in that final segment in particular, and how important that is with the test optional movements. I found it pretty interesting. You know, she said that really exceptional scores only, at least at those test optional programs, are the ones that are going to make any sort of impact. I would argue that, and this is happening at a college level as well, that the more that these sort of test optional and test blind practices kick in at these schools, they'll realize it's a mess to not have test scores on people and to be able to try to evaluate them in terms of these qualitative measures. What do you have left? You've got grades, which are inflated. You've got fairly arbitrary if you're trying to weigh them based on other schools. You've got admissions essays, which are potentially written by other people or at least doctored or impacted by AI. And then what else do you have? Resume, maybe. Really, you're having to clutch at a lot of different things that are going to be very difficult to weigh individuals against each other if you don't have some sort of testing on that person. So I think the exceptional test scores are going to tend to matter more and more, particularly when you're talking about competitive schools, again, as this sort of movement goes on. For advanced students, really that is the segment of the population that's going to benefit the most from really focusing on these secondary school tests, SSAT and ISEE. Another observation I had was the one about voracious readers kind of having all of the advantages when you're talking about English writing sections of these standardized tests. I think that's true. I mean, I think there's no better way of gaining vocabulary and reading comprehension and being able to glean tone from an author, you know, all of those really fundamental skills that are very much tested by these tests. And those are the difficult ones to teach, to be frank, because you can teach the quadratic formula. You can teach how to apply that more precisely. That's kind of a more finite skill, something that can also be applied on a more short-term basis. And also a lot of the trickery around the testing and the strategizing, all of that, the cracking the test, a lot of those are math strategies. Yes, there are some that apply to English, process elimination, that sort of thing. But if you want to invoke one skill in your child, if you want them to come out of their childhood with one thing, it's a love of reading, the love of it. And it doesn't matter what the reading is, whether it's graphic novels, whether it's back of cereal boxes, it doesn't matter. Blogs on video gaming, I mean, some form of writing that they actually like, that they're passionate about and they enjoy, finding that, helping them find that, that is really going to light the right path for students in terms of these English and writing sections. So I don't know if there's any more important thing that a parent can do is lead their child toward reading. Another thing we circled around on throughout the conversation really was that theme of the involvement of the parent and the role of the parent. And I think as my children get a little bit older, my daughter is, you know, approaching 12 now, and so she's right in this range, and we're thinking about where are we going to send her for middle school and then high school and that sort of thing. We're kind of approaching these questions now. The more and more I realize how hard it is to not get carried away and like get very involved emotionally in that process myself, because education is obviously so important to me, and I just feel like I have a lot to offer to my oldest and, you know, obviously all my kids. So curbing my enthusiasm, I think, is a big part of my personal challenge in approaching this process. I guess I understand that, but it is important. I think it is important to kind of take a step back and allow the student to discover their own strengths and weaknesses themselves and that whole process and how they want to go about it and how committed they want to be to studying, preparing, you know, because at the end of the day, their engagement is going to determine what happens with how well they do on that particular test. And I mean, really at the end of the day, let's be frank, it's their life. So whatever my vision or passions about it are, it's really kind of secondary, you know, if you take a broader view of their lives.